Yeah.
So what was the neurological basis for your talking about anarchy that I'm not sure if I got the coherent thought there.
To lend a great deal of support to the idea that the actual free participation of people in building a world together is actually how we really live. It's there all the time. But the particular way in which we experience it, and the very roundabout, mediated, alienated form of interaction in a capitalist world, which is expresses itself most of all in the fact that we can never actually experience that process. And there are certainly have been cultural communities that have. I read especially early Chinese philosophy, and not just the Taoists, but also people like Confucius and Mencius, as talking about how it is that one orients oneself to a process which runs, I mean, in which you are seamlessly a part of, and the way, which is sort of the current of everything, but which cannot be separated or described because it's simply how everything is at that moment, is a pretty good way of expressing the neurological reality, which is it's unbelievably incomprehensibly complex, and it's never the same from instant to instant. There are no instants anyway. And it's always changing. You know, we're just sort of temporary points of stability or apparent stability in a process that keeps, you know, that keeps going and is simply us. There isn't any larger process over and above that. So that we all continue to make it together. So that everyone in this room is busy making capitalism, myself included, at this moment. You know, we're all sort of sustaining the world. And the question is how to transform the way in which we live bit by bit or jump by jump so that eventually we're sustaining a much more human world.
You mentioned that last year you came to the RAD conference and were inspired by a political tradition that you didn't see yourself as connected to, but then saw that you were. Could you talk about that process of what specifically you were inspired by? In other words, where are the threads do you see there?
I think very much the emphasis on action, especially in the case of, you know, people like the Spanish anarchists. The rural Spanish anarchists to the workers of Barcelona, in making in actually trying to live particular ways and understand that they weren't going to be able to tell how it was to develop. To understand that the practice itself was what they learned from and what constitutes the theory. I mean, one of my favorite lines that I think makes it into the epigraphs at the beginning of the book is Goethe saying, don't look for anything behind the phenomena. They themselves are the theory. And actually it was Goethe that led me to Fichte, but in the same way, the practice is the theory, and the test of a good theory seems to be something that liberates you to begin practicing. And there was, I think for me, it was more of an emotional resonance. You know, I saw in at RAT some of the same kind of thinking that, you know, appeals to everybody in the Zapatistas, you know, walking, we question, and essentially the path is laid down in the walking of it. And because it's a tremendous responsibility. And it requires a very keen sensitivity to what it is that one is actually doing. Because practice in itself, you know, very easily becomes something that you think about in order to do. To put it in a somewhat different plane, there's a story that D.H. Lawrence and his wife were out riding one day when they were visiting in Taos, New Mexico. And his wife said to her husband, she said, I just love the feel of the horse's strong flank between my thighs. And he said, nonsense, Frida. You're feeling nothing of the sort. You've been reading too many of my novels. And I think, you know, it's the same way with, you know, it's very easy to think that you're really practicing, and what you're doing is enjoying the idea of it. You know, the actual practice is something which changes you. And it's not, you know, I'm going to go throw a brick through this Starbucks, and tomorrow I'm going to go throw a brick through that Starbucks. That's theoretical. I mean, that's all head-driven. You know, that doesn't actually issue from, and maybe the first one is something that issues from something that you genuinely feel, but then it becomes, oh, if I do this, I'm going to feel a particular way. That's actually theory to me. You know, you don't open yourself to the experience at that point.
So this is a question just to make sure I understand correctly. In the same way that, for example, a bird doesn't consciously know how to explain flight, yet it flies. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, it's the nature of our existence to surf the split between past and future, dealing with the discrete instances of time which we're dealing with. That when we start breaking those out into smaller and smaller discrete elements of actions, that eventually they blend into a continuous curve that is, for lack of a better way to put it, co-locationary with time. And that how we act is the same way as a bird flying or a fish swimming, and we're totally unaware of it, yet somehow we can change the world by laying down the path as we walk. Is that essentially what you're talking about?
I guess I could get hung up on saying that you can't break things down to achieve any kind of whole, you end up with things like Zeno's paradox. But I think your point is, it seems to me the question that I hear about it is, if we're just sort of animals doing what we do, how can we change it?
It wasn't really a question so much as a restatement. I wanted to make sure I understood.
Simply put, if that touches on things like the free will determinism argument, I don't think those ever go anywhere. We do obviously change the world. We do obviously act. I think if you want to talk about whether it's free or not, and I know you didn't bring that up, but I maybe it was important for me to pretend that's what you thought. You know, to ask if I am an individual, am acting freely, is a nonsensical question. But to say, are human acts, considering them as part of the world, free? Well, the entire system is not determined by anything. So presumably I act freely as I act as part of everyone else. You know, it's obvious that we do different things, and I'm not going to try to explain that away as some sort of, some sort of unconscious phenomenon. But what I do want to argue is that's not something. When Marx says, for instance, that, you know, men make their own history, but they do not make it just, you know, as they choose. They make it from what is around. And of course, you know, he should have said people make their own history. It's true, and it's true in a very deep sense. And, you know, in the sense that, in a way, what we do is something that is also done by everybody else who's been before us and been around us. You know, we're sort of just the current incarnations of a system. As, for instance, among the Inuit, each child is just, or the traditional Northwest Coast Indians, the community was made up of a certain number of names. And each child was that name. You know, the name had been left by somebody who died, and then they come back. And the community maintains itself that way. And everyone is, in a way, acting through the entire history of the name. I think that's probably a more intelligent understanding of the way human beings really are than the way we go about doing it. We are all just, you know, the current people acting for humanity.
What I have thought you were, where I thought you were going, was precisely that we are dominated by acting unconsciously, and that the way out of the trap was to become conscious, be aware of what we're doing, including be aware of the possibilities and alternatives and so forth. That's not what you're saying?
I think, I mean, it can't, the processes can't be brought to consciousness.
Social
processes, to a large extent, can, yes, but the unconscious processes that I'm talking about, and they're actually going to be the social processes to a large extent. How you go about doing that, I don't want to get into that. I certainly have seen lots of cultures that have, and I don't know if any of this is going to play into some of the things that Alejandro will be talking about in the context of David Graeber's book. Certainly, since I've been reading a lot of anthropology, especially a lot of things on hunting cultures, there's a lot to be learned from the way in which cultures like the Eskimo and the Inuit had built their world, in which there are multiple levels of signification to all sorts of things. You know, if you think about everything that a whale hunt is, you know, it's everything from a form of social control to a passion play to, you know, and it's an economic activity too. And it's scary and fun, and it's a real adventure. And it reads in many different ways, and it sort of has the space in which the kind of emotional complex that develops in those particular sets of actions can find expression in different ways. You know, and we don't have that any longer. You know,
as you say, we're maintaining capitalism. Mm-hmm. And if we assume...
For God's sake, stop! I'm sorry.
Well, that's just it. If we assume that the problem is not just theoretical, but how do we get to stop maintaining capitalism and move on to a better form of society, some kind of socialist anarchism or something, then what? How does it follow from it?
I guess, you know, yes, I'm talking about, you know, not really becoming so much aware in the sense of being able to transform one's experience, but to start opening the space in which different forms of interaction can actually begin to form. As people learn to live together or produce together in different ways, and they may be as bourgeois sounding in the beginning as things like co-housing communities, as in Denmark, free schools, all of these are tremendously useful. I think where I'm spending my time these days is just trying to understand how invisible capitalism is in general. And it can certainly be addressed, you know, at this stage in terms of, you know, you really need to understand why your jobs are disappearing, you know, and why we ran through so much of the oil of the world and so on. So in fact, what I'm working on now is a series of small comic books. so that, you know, to be distributed cheaply to, you know, like Jack Chick's comic books are, to, you know, that's how the evangelicals got Christianity into a mainstream thing, you know. And what it seems that I know that I need to do right now is to try to make capital discussion of capitalism into a mainstream thing, you know, so that at least people can begin to start saying no to it. And once you start saying no to it, and you start, at that point, you can start developing support for opening spaces in which people can start living and producing differently. And out of that is what's going to, I think, going to be the seeds of what I hope, you know, survives capitalism. Because if we don't find something else to survive capitalism, none of us are going to survive at all. I know there's something about against apocalyptic anarchism, but, you know, apocalyptic capitalism is another matter.
I guess I'm a little curious about your aversion to theory, or your, I sympathize with what you're saying, and I'm really fascinated about the neurology stuff, but I wonder if perhaps, how do you change without, I mean, are you saying that self-reflection is not actually possible? And perhaps you might define exactly what you mean by theory, the ladder that you're dropping,
yeah,
so to speak, from,
yeah,
I'm using another image from medieval theology. But, and how do you keep that then, this walking the walk, from lapsing into a kind of mysticism? That would be my concern.
Yeah, I understand. I'm not... You know, for one thing, I have the problems with theory that only somebody who's like obsessed with theory and theorizes everything would have. You know, but no, and self-reflection is obviously something that is tremendously useful. But theory as, you know, of course, the well, not of course, because probably you would, you know, if you've done medieval theology, you probably know the etymology of theory. I mean, originally, theria meant contemplation. But what it means for us by now is the construction of a veridical model of the world. Something that will, essentially, it seems that since Christianity decided to set itself against the classical city and picked up Platonic philosophy, which had been a crackpot affair, through the classical world because it was radically anti-civic, it picked it up as sort of the main theoretical arsenal. The obsession of people in the Latin West has been, really, to make a scale model of the world. You know, and to correspond to that, a scale model of the human being, something that we, this is where the title of the book comes from, something that we could think about, something that could capture the processes of the world with sufficient accuracy that we could say what it was and what it was going to do next. And it's that sort of assumption of upon which the identification of the human being with the conscious thinking subject rests. And I think that it only appeared to be viable as long as it came with a divine guarantee.
Okay.
Because, you know, only revelation can actually tell you what is significant in the flux of life. And, you know, otherwise there's no filter.
But perhaps you could flip that then. I mean, this is kind of one of my own pet projects. To get back to the notion of contemplation as something, contemplating something that is before you, to change the notion of theory to, for want of a better word, a kind of erotic theory, that it is what drags you forward, the way Aristotle's unmoved mover moves things towards it, without ever actually... realizing necessarily, because it would always recede towards the future, something that you go towards.
You see, to me that sounds too metaphysical. I, if if anything, I would lean more towards a sort of Levinasian thing. Emmanuel Levinas, L-E-V-I-N-A-S, who was actually both a Talmudist and a philosopher, died, what, 30 years ago or so? Okay, less than that. And interestingly, my wife, who's a photographer and photojournalist, finds my talk about Levinas very, very useful, because there he's talking about the absolute otherness of the other. And the real ethical stance is that in which one permits oneself to be transformed by that. And I have a lot of sympathy with that. I mean, it's, and when I lecture her photography students on ethics, she's written things for the National Press photographers as well, and photographers read this, and it essentially says that, you know, what a real photograph, a real work of art comes from is it records the process of transformation that happens between you and the other. And it's not a photograph of the other, and it's not a projection of you either. And they recognize that that is what they do. And I think that kind of, you know, if you want to call that theory, then I'm all for that kind of theory.
I guess I'm trying to explain something like a political stance as something that, you know, the leap rather than a kind of deontological notion of theory is something from the top-down model that you then see explicating or applying to reality rather than a set of goals or ideals that might not be actually governing you but actually drawing you.
I have to think about it. Maybe we could talk later on. It's because
It seems, correct me if I'm wrong, and once again I'm trying to exactly understand where you're coming from. It seems like you're speaking to a criticism of causality arguments, in particular the idea that we're going to create the wonderful world by the tools that we have at our availability within capitalism, for instance, and or by our scale model of the world that allows us to totally understand the world, and instead, and that the language you used earlier was that your area of interest is more in effect-laden processes, and that our examination looks whatever should be more concerned there.
I guess to a certain extent, I don't like capitalism because it just smells bad. You know, it just revolts me, and I think that's worthwhile. I don't know, you know, where I'd go with that. I realize, you know, I really was sort of hoping I was, it's late and I hadn't thought about questions and so on before, but I was really sort of hoping that I could have done something more in the way of like nonviolent communication or something, and I guess, you know, is there anything that you have to, I mean, you've spoken, anything you have to say or not, and you know, because I'm just curious about what people think and what it means to them, if at all, or did I leave you befuddled?
No,
you've already spoken. I mean, okay. People who haven't spoken.
I couldn't help.
I'm still trying to digest this. So. I don't know. I don't have anything to say as of right now.
Okay.
I guess at this point, what I'm taking away from this, what you're talking about is coming to a sort of new understanding of our alienation, and that a political practice that is constructed within a world in which we're fundamentally alienated can't resolve alienation. So the first step is to reach a point of not being alienated. And I think that's what I'm hearing and what you're talking about, like sub-personal processes. It's like, even if we can't grasp that, because grasping that as a concept is in and of itself to be a form of alienation.
Mm.
It has to be inhabited.
So.
I'm befuddled.
Okay. It's okay.
Befuddled and digesting. Biologist, so I'm still stuck on the mirror neurons, and I'm really trying to like stick them with the rest of this, and I'm having a hard time. I'm just trying to place that in context, like to understand how you're using that idea.
I think of them as the fact that our own neurological activity is to some significant level actually a reflection of the neurological activity of the people around us.
So what kind of implication then are you drawing from that? That's where I'm trying to make.
Okay, I think it's a very suggestive example, one of the possible physical ways in which the sort of social psychology of people picking up on each other's feelings, thoughts, the way, in the very odd way, especially when as therapists say, you know, you're ready. When the student is ready, the teacher appears. You know, and when you're genuinely ready to find that person, they're there. You know, and in an extraordinary number of times, you know, you discover amazing connections that you have had, you know, odd tastes and things you have in common with somebody with whom you've just somehow known there's something odd about. I like that voice. We do read each other in very deep levels, and not in any mystical way, and I think the mirror neurons help explain, you know, how some of that might be possible, or at least a start.
Can I ask a question about neurons?
Okay.
What is a neuron? And then secondly, is this mirror neuron thing you're talking about similar to, like, if I watch someone yawn, I'm going to repeat that? Is that similar?
I don't know about the yawning.
Okay.
Neurons are the brain cells, so those cells in the brain, which your brain has more neurons than there are stars in the known universe. So actually, you know, a few hundred mirror neurons would be nothing, but apparently they do have some effect. So.
I'm just soaking it all up. Okay.
Person in sweater with carrot. Oh, and you, sitting on the floor. Anything? And you're the speaker's bureau person?
Yes. I do have something.
Yeah.
Well, I was more inclined when Wayne suggested, is this what you're saying? Becoming aware of it and then... And you said no to his question, and then later on you went back to saying something about becoming, having to stop, like stopping, and then taking action, or creating agency.
Mm-hmm.
How do you stop? Like, what is that moment of stopping? I mean, that is becoming aware, yeah?
It's becoming aware, yes, it's becoming aware in some ways. I mean, if you want, I think it's like Buddhist becoming aware, which is finally learning that there's no secret. You know, really understanding that this is it. You know, before studying Zen, you know, people are people and mountains are mountains. And while studying Zen, things are very confused. But you know, after you've achieved enlightenment, people are people and mountains are mountains. I think the way you stop is to start seeing how we're driven to impose certain things on ourselves as well as others. How 99% of what's in culture consists of kits with which to bully yourself into the simulacrum of happiness without ever actually experiencing anything. Because experience is dangerous, you know, and that I think is one way of trying to stop. Let's see, you in the baseball cap, standing?
I think it's interesting, if everyone was interested in different models of organizing, and like, I'm thinking about like models of interaction, models of the kind of interaction that can manifest itself in organizing and doing stuff basically. And it's interesting to have Arcanics. I wanted to hear about, you know, how there are all these models that are already active in our bodies or active in like in biology and whatnot. So I'm interested in that, thinking about it. So
And I'm the worst person to talk about action, actually, because I spend all my time in my house. But I theorize about being able not to theorize anymore. Yes, person in red.
I'm another biologist. So.
Okay. And I know that, you know, as much of an amateur philosopher I am, I'm a worse amateur biologist. But. Okay. Okay, thanks. And you, person with the glasses in the back?
There's two people with glasses in the back. Hidden person.
It's interesting.
Yeah, that's why we're in the back.
You will not be graded.
I guess I'm sort of floating around the ideas. I mean, I feel like things have, you know, and kind of bouncing things around. In terms of this question of action, or this question of sort of like moving to a new process or a new beginning, to me I find that sort of possibility of the new, right? Taking on this moment where we're suddenly free from capitalist alienation, a little bit suspicious as a possibility. I mean, being that we're constantly stuck in the middle. I'm interested sort of in what model you're using to get to that point where one does kind of find renewal or find a new sort of unalienated being, and I'm not.
I don't have one.
Yeah.
I mean, I think right now we're, you know, we can't even think about planting the garden. We, you know, there are an awful lot of weeds and stones we have to dig out first. You know, I think, to me, what I think we need to do is a lot of preparatory work and a lot of trying to really, as I said before, to try to clear a space in which, you know, it may not be our generation that actually is able to start growing things. But you know, we at least have an awful lot to do to try to open up that, you know, sort of the experienceable space of our lives. And, you know, I don't believe you could sort of, we're going to be able to walk out the door into the new at any point.
With that, the question around kind of the function of discourse within capitalism being this kind of smokescreen that we're, you know, just kind of treading over it, super mixed metaphor. In that you're viewing, say, kind of representational militant action as a form of theory, right? And that theory also is a form of theory. Is there any out in that kind of bind that you presented?
I don't, you know, I really don't know if there's, you know, I'm not an authority, you know. I don't know if there's a way to have like a genuinely revolutionary mass politics. If there is, I hope I'll recognize it and join it. I think it's possible to have. I want to see it. If it is possible, you know, it may come, and it'll be wonderful, and I won't be the person to invent it, that's for sure. And I just hope I'm not so stupid to miss it. But I think it's possible to do transformational work in small communities and, you know, within collectives and so on. And that there's always room for that, I hope. You know, and just understanding that we're, you know, that, you know, my wife Loretta is always disappointed if I don't tell the man from Sung story in Mencius that apparently 2,500 years ago, the Polak jokes of warring states China was the Sung joke. And there was a man from Sung, said Mencius, who wanted his crops to grow faster. So he went out and he pulled on each plant. And he came home and stretched and said to his children, "I'm so tired, I've been stretching the crops all day." And they ran out and the crops were withered. That's, you know, that's the other danger. And it's a danger that, you know, that is really understandable considering how bad things are. But, you know, there's, you know, the Lenin who said, you know, "I hate to listen to Beethoven because it makes me want to hug people instead of crack them on the head. And this world is so terrible, you have to crack a lot of people on the head." So, you know. Other person wearing glasses. Okay, Ben.
I missed the very, very beginning, but I was kind of thinking about how you were talking about this universalizing of capitalism, but it's also empty, and the discourse is pointless. The discourse of capitalism is pointless. But how kind of like, at least in the U.S., like the neoconservatives and the religious right also see, and also the fact of it being allowing for social expression and diversity of expression, that the neoconservatives and religious right also see its emptiness,
mm-hmm.
and also see that it allows for possibly too much freedom, especially kind of neoliberal capitalism allows for everyone to just do whatever they want on a certain level. Well, not everyone in the world, but under a certain, you know, in certain situations, so that they are kind of like waiting. I mean, they have had a certain kind of revolution, I guess, in a way. I don't know what I'm saying exactly, but just thinking about that we're not the only ones looking at its emptiness and making plans.
That is really scary. In sometimes easier to talk with conservatives because traditional conservatives, because they at least understand that there's a social world, and liberals don't. And from a religious point of view, it's easy to see, you know, many of the things that are wrong, but they see them in odd kind of alienated ways, you know. But very often they are responding to real problems. Then they're not responding to. I mean, even within liberal sense, there are some obvious problems that they're not responding to, such as, you know, inequality in public health, but it's another. Yes, person in with blue, you actually. Oh, okay.
No, I mean, I'm fairly confused, and I guess I had a couple of questions in some ways, going back and forth in terms of trying to understand your position on agency. And also trying to also verify whether or not you think that people do understand and do see a social world. And I'm also confused about this notion of enlightenment, that not just enlightenment, but this way of like how people get to be agents of social change, and the idea that, I don't know, like you don't have to be enlightened to know that you're oppressed, and
right.
that you need to change that, and then in fact that we are all embedded agents of change. And that we're all part of reproducing the world and the world that we've inherited, reproducing that as human beings and at the same time changing that. And I guess I'm just having a really hard time making sense of what you're saying.
Okay, well, that's fair enough. The problem to me is that, yeah, you know something's wrong if you're oppressed, but you don't always know what it is. You know, and fascism took, you know, that as its one of its foundations. Nativism, attacks on immigrants for taking jobs away. There are lots of, you know, anti-Semitism, as they used to say in Europe. It's the socialism of fools. People knew something was wrong, And so they decided it was a conspiracy by the Jews. That's what was wrong. You know, a certain degree, it seems to me, a certain degree of maybe, you know, not Buddhist enlightenment, but a certain degree of theoretical clarity is really important. You need to try to understand, you know, we can't get away from making some kind of models of the world. What we have to understand is that it is not the world. That doesn't mean that, you know, you can say, well, you know, the situation is different from moment to moment. So we can't talk about anything general like capitalism. That may sound like a contradiction in terms, but you know, as I said, there's a kind of loose fit between the way we think about things and the way we experience them. But they do sort of still clothe the body of experience. We can critique it, we can recognize it, but there are strict limits to how far away from it we can go. I'm sure that's a completely unsatisfactory answer, and it really is something that I need to think more thoroughly through, and I appreciate your comments. Person in cap?
I really liked the phrase, the gravitational pull of reality.
Thank you. Kat?
I'm still knocking around in my mind right now.
Okay. Well, Hadra?
Let me see. I had a question, but then I went off in another direction. Let me just ask this. I guess I'm just curious. I mean, it seems to me that there are lots of varieties of anarchism, and some of them I think do tend to emphasize the question of alienation a great deal, and the kind of historical singularity of capitalism a great deal, that it generates this way of being human that's a historical anomaly. But I think that's also possible to come up with very politically and ethically compelling descriptions that don't require that, and that have, I think, important practical outcomes. So for example, I mean, when you said, and several times it's been said, we're all reproducing capitalism. Okay, I mean, I can accept that claim, but it's entirely different if I also say that I'm also quite aware of not reproducing it at certain times.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm aware of that precisely in an affective way. Those are moments of enormous pleasure for me, moments of great intensity. So
mm-hmm.
that if I simply describe those as I am alienated in a capitalist world, and I give myself a description that's based on a series of negations, this is what I'm not doing, or this is how I'm modeling things and coming short, I end up with a certain kind of narrative. If I give myself a kind of dual ontological power narrative, so to speak, where I say, well, okay, I accept that I'm constantly being forced and unconsciously accepting all of these acts, which ultimately I see as humiliating and complicit. But also, here's this whole other series of acts, which I agree are often occluded, but nevertheless, they're taking place. And more than that, I mean, that's, if I was to talk concretely about what else there is, that's where I would start.
That's really good, actually. And I should just, like, stop saying that, because you're reminding me, sort of, not knowing that you're reminding me of this, that I keep falling back into the idea that, you know, again, that we're unitary agents. And in fact, you know, a lot, what I should be saying is a lot of what we do maintains capitalism. But that doesn't mean that we don't do other things that don't maintain capitalism, and that, that our actual experiences outside of that, the idea that they are somehow, like, you know, that there is a coherent, centered, you know, soul or mind, mm-hmm. to which ever all of that is ascribed, is one of the big problems. You know, we are actually, you know, beings who sort of navigate through these, you know, incredibly complex set of interconnections. You know, the idea that there's one of us somehow there is...
If you begin from that, I mean, especially if you begin by talking about the complexity of the brain and so on, it just seems to me awfully odd to move from that to give him one overarching description
exactly.
of all our behaviors.
Well, which is why I'm saying...
I guess, like, you know, I mean, to go back, I mean, you were asking about what compelled you about Rat. You know, I think it was my experience, I think it's a lot of folks' experiences that... that if what you tasted first was some version of Marxism, there's something quite refreshing about anarchism and models that say, oh, well, look, here's this thing called mutual aid. It's actually everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
All the time, people are spontaneously, semi-consciously, or very consciously engaging in it.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas, so, I'm generalizing the other direction, but so many Marxists spend all this time figuring out where is this consciousness, how do we bring the consciousness of oppression about,
mm-hmm.
and whereas you have this other rather practical question that anarchists would like to ask, which is, well, how do we,
yeah.
we make more mutual aid happen?
Mm-hmm.
Well, first we can go discover all the places where it's already happening, so the cognitive situation is quite different in each case.
Yeah. Yeah, no, but you know, it's absolutely right that you know, as I go on, I tend to fall back into exactly that which I'm trying to critique. And I, you know, I could defend that by saying, well, it just proves how powerful that is. But, you know, I should...
This is your Maturana, though. I mean, like, when you were talking about Maturana, I mean, if we continually talk about alienation, we're going to be pretty freaking alienated.
Yes.
You know? And it doesn't mean that you shouldn't talk about things that are humiliating or you feel that you're suffering or other people are suffering, but if there's no joy whatsoever to talk about...
Yeah, believe me, I've you know, it's... Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think that what perhaps... you're talking about, and I mean, you haven't said explicitly yet, or I haven't heard anyone say explicitly, is that within all of this, there are very real structures that capitalism produces and reproduces on us and on the world, and even things that, as like groups that are conscious to one another, you know, we might do these things that we call mutual aid, quote unquote, but they can also have a function where they are reabsorbed into capitalism, and their net effect is to uphold the system rather than to bring it down, whatever, destroy it. I think that's where perhaps the cognitive element comes into play. Not that, I mean, obviously we all have different cognitions, but there's a consciousness that can introduce, you know, counter structures that are real, as real as capitalism.
And we're all sufficiently incoherent, happily, that we can do both. And there's no reason to say that one is authentic and the other is inauthentic. You know, and yes, it is, you know, wonderful to have an actual human exchange with anyone. And if we didn't have that, we probably wouldn't understand what a world would be like that we'd really want to live in. You know, there is a kind of you know, what it feels like to hold someone's hand.
Mm-hmm.
It explains itself. And I should stop talking about us as, you know, as if we were, you know, like monolithically doing one thing or another. Because there's no doubt we do a lot of things, not all of which could be counted as, you know, producing one thing or another. And I'm talking too long, so. Yeah.
I really like what you have said.
And you may think about a lot of stuff, in particular the fact that the back to the neurons and the mirror neurons, if that's true in the sense that we replicate or our brain replicate the same neural pathways that we watch someone else, like pick up a pen, in that same way, if we're all consistently acting in ways that are actively acting in ways that are contrary to the existing structures, like capitalist structures and other oppressive structures, then other people will see us and mirror us. And so in that sense, that, I don't know, it probably doesn't work exactly like that, but that's an idea I like.
Yeah, and I think the reason I talk about saying no is because to be, you know, the actual, you know, the mutual aid is everything. I mean, it's always going on everywhere because we are always sort of together making the world. And so just like, you know, Simone Weil could be confident because she believed in the existence of God, that if she cleared everything away, God would be there. So I'm quite confident that, you know, our actual connections with each other are all there all the time. And you?
I think I'm going to eat a bit of too much cheesecake to, like, like, one thing that you said that really jumped out in my mind was capitalism being invincible, or invisible. Maybe.
Get out of here.
But, no, not invincible. Sorry. I don't know. I mean, I'm talking and meeting people every day where, like, you know, capitalism is so omnipresent, and people, I think, who are especially on, like, the negative end, like, are identifying that. Like, someone touched on this before. I've always kind of felt that, like, you know, if people aren't recognizing, you know, phenomena like white supremacy or capitalism or patriarchy, they're probably benefiting from them. I mean, I don't know. Like, I'm confused by that.
Yeah. Well, I get stuck reading the mainstream media a lot, and it's invisible there, boy. You know, it's everybody takes very seriously Margaret Thatcher's Tina. There is no alternative, and that's the point, that's where I was thinking, you know, of it, you know, it needs to appear there. There have to be enough people, right. Ordinary people, mainstream, boring people who say, you know, oh, this is capitalism, and there are actually things other than capitalism.
But, like, you know, if your welfare check ain't cutting it, you know, and if you can't put food on the table.
Well, that's something else. But the thing is that those are not the people who read or write Time magazine. And yet, in 19, apologies to those of you who've heard this statistic before. It's one of my favorites. In 1942, Fortune magazine polls. Fortune is, after all, the business part of the loose empire. 25% of Americans looked to the creation of a socialist America, and 35% said they would have an open mind about it. So that's 60% of the people responding to a Fortune poll actually considered the possibility of socialism. And, you know, that they made sure that didn't last, if you want. And you know, it was possible in the 30s and 40s to say, here's capitalism, here's what it does. Now it's, here's the economy, what can we do with it? You know, it doesn't occur to people that it's just a particular way of doing an economy. And, you know, it's that level that I think, you know, needs to be penetrated. Not because I'm looking to founding an anarchist party that will get a majority in Congress, but just to have sort of enough sympathizers and fellow travelers and sort of space out of which recruitment comes, so that, you know, the whole edifice begins to get holes in it. That's why I'm doing comics. Yeah. That's another story. Anybody who hasn't spoken, come up with anything they want to say? Is everybody had? Oh, yes.
Yes, just to go back to the connection between neurology and anarchism.
Yeah.
Sorry to do this at the very end. I'm just wondering, like, when you spoke, I was unclear as to whether the connection was the idea of the mirror neurons and, I guess, maybe this is oversimplifying, but the idea that our brains are built in such a way that anarchism makes the most sense for our brains, or that anarchism mirrors the way in which our brains work, and therefore, like...
Yeah, no, actually, I don't think, if it's oversimplifying, it's probably not much oversimplifying how I oversimplify. I think there are a lot of different reasons, and the mirror neurons are only one of them, for thinking that our brains are really very social things, and our neurological life, and our bodily life, is a life in which we are constantly changing and reflecting each other. And so the understanding of human beings as people who are biologically not just given to mutual aid, but people who are biologically always echoing and speaking back to one another and collaborating in this project of having a world, really lends itself to the anarchist idea that genuinely human organization swells up spontaneously from the way human beings living a human life evolve together a community. And so in that sense, I would say, yeah, and it's probably, unless anybody else has something to say, I think it's a really nice place to end, is to say that, yeah, there are lots of reasons for thinking that kind of anarchism really mirrors what we know what human beings are really like.